Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And before we meet our panel, we take a look at the front pages of the papers and the energy in the papers that suddenly surged into migration and the broader issue of migration into the country. So the Mail on Sunday, the quote, Harris has 6 weeks to get results. This is cabinet ministers telling the Mail on Sunday. Well, it does seem from that piece and a sense across the papers that in the migration space, the focus for now is moving off Roderick O'Gorman and the focus is very much moving on to Helen McEntee. The Sunday Times, asylum claims to more than double this year and government fury over Sunak's Rwanda plan comments is the strap there. The Sunday Independent, similar scramble to end migrants arriving via UK backdoor. New plan, asylum seekers will be given deportation orders within 3 months, and that the fast-tracked asylum process is being extended from safe countries, but also, as we heard during the week, to countries with the highest number of migrants currently coming from there. The Business Post gone in a slightly different tack, revealed McGrath urged to woo private funds to hit housing targets. Senior officials warning cast doubt on state's plan to deliver 50,000 homes a year. The Sun is leading with the family of Kinahan hit victim Noel Duckegg Kerwin, and they have vowed to continue their fight for justice. The Sunday World is leading with that Adam Clayton and his wife Mariana are getting a divorce amicably and they're focusing on their daughter who is six. And the Mirror is leading with an interview with Siobhan Carney, whose brother Liam was unlawfully killed in the Stardust. Now, our panel today, Oisin Coughlan, Chief Executive Friends of the Earth Ireland. Wendy Grace is a broadcaster and columnist. Dr. Mick Molloy is a consultant in emergency medicine. And Louise Byrne is political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It feels, Louise, like a scrappy, it feels scrappy around the place, doesn't it? And politics feels scrappy as well around the whole migration thing, that there's an element of everybody's passing books and blaming everybody and all that kind of thing. So maybe if we start with that. So the front page of the Sunday Independent, we knew some of this already, but I suppose it's crystallising now. What is their plan right now and what's going to happen in the next few days? The main point being that it seems now people are saying up to 90% of the immigrants coming in are coming through the north.
Yeah, and I mean, this has really been a story that's been building and building all week, to be honest. And I think it started with Justice Minister Helen McEntee at the Oireachtas Justice Committee on Tuesday. And a lot of this actually went under the radar because it's the same day as the Stardust apology. So attentions were elsewhere. So it's kind of built as the week went on. But what Minister McEntee had said is that it seemed that around 80% of people who had sought asylum, who had turned up at the International Protection Office on Main Street in Dublin seeking protection, seemed to have come from across the Northern Irish border. Now, I guess that kind of raised questions about why this sudden influx of people crossing the border who would come over from Britain. And to kind of discuss that, I think you have to mention the court case that was in the Irish High Court last month that said that Justice Minister Helen McEntee had previously labelled the UK a safe country because of that Rwanda policy that they're now implementing. The High Court ruled last month that the UK can no longer be branded a safe country. That to say that is unlawful. So that kind of presents its own issues wherein that you can't particularly send people back to a country that's not deemed safe. So that seemed to have kind of created this loophole, as someone in government put it to me during the week, where you have this court ruling, you have a lot of people coming, and what can you do with that? So I suppose to address that concern, Justice Minister Helen McEntee, we're told in the Sunday Independent today by Philip Ryan, will be bringing plans to Cabinet on Tuesday. And what that will effectively be saying, according to Philip, is that people who enter Ireland through the Northern Ireland risk being sent back to their country of origin. So they won't be sent back to the UK, they'll be sent back to wherever it is that they have come from originally. A government source is saying that most people are actually coming from Nigeria. We also saw the figures of people seeking asylum here from Nigeria, and it's increased. So as of this week, they're now subject to a new fast track application where their application will be assessed within 90 days. But there seems to be a little bit of an argument brewing between the Irish and the British governments about Micheál Martin saying that, well, we're getting all these people now because of this Rwanda policy that British government has introduced where they sent migrants to Rwanda. He's kind of saying, well, it's fairly obvious that if you're faced with the prospect of going to Rwanda, you're going to go somewhere else. Rishi Sunak hitting back yesterday saying, well, that just shows our plan is working. So kind of this back and forth. We know Justice Minister Helen McEntee will meet her UK counterpart James Cleverly tomorrow, and that will all be discussed. But it really seems to be building. I think the main kind of focus of government now is to stop people coming across the border, which is very hard when you have free travel and something that's so protected and was so hard fought for as free travel across the Northern Irish border.
Okay. Well done. I think most people's heads were spinning all week trying to follow things. So there we got a summation of it there. And just to cap it off, so it sounds like what they're proposing now is that that High Court case they lost about the UK being a safe country. Am I right in thinking they're not going to try and appeal that case or anything? Instead, they're going to change the law that they lost the case under. Is that the idea? That seems
to be the idea. And the Attorney General, Rossa Fanning, is looking at that. And as someone described to me last week or during the week, you know, it's trying to close that loophole that was created by that case in the High Court last month. And it's, as someone said to me, it's not an easy thing to do. When I was speaking to someone on Wednesday or Thursday, they didn't actually know if they were going to have this to go to Cabinet next week. So they seem to have gotten their skates on this. But it seems that rather than trying to fight that case or do whatever, this is the tact, this is new legislation. The Taoiseach said it during the week, Simon Harris, that he believed that there was new legislation needed. So they're acting fast, which is not something you can often say about the Irish government.
Okay. Oisin, you also looked at that front page of the Sunday Independent, scramble to end migrants arriving via UK backdoor.
Yeah, I was struck by the use of the phrase backdoor, I'll come to, but I think what Sunak's response saying, this shows my policy is working, shows that very little of this is actually about having a coherent system for judging people's right to asylum. And it's all about appearing tougher than your neighbour so people go somewhere else. Like, it's not about actually processing them well or respecting their rights or having a clear system. It's about, well, if we're tougher than the UK or the UK is tougher than France, people will choose somewhere else to go. Because I think it's John Mooney says migration is like water. It's going to happen and it's going to keep happening more and more, and it'll find the weakest spot. But I was struck
John,
by
the... By the way, just a thing to note that I noted in John Mooney's piece, he also says, I don't know if this is true or not, that Gardaí have set up hundreds of checkpoints in the border region trying to stop people coming through. Do you know anything about that?
That was the first I heard of it in John's piece this morning. And I think, as John quite rightly said, you have issues. Could you be accused of racial profiling? What kind of other issues is that going to come up? So I think that's something you have to be very careful
with. It's important to just keep perspective as well. The numbers are increasing, but the number of people claiming asylum in Ireland so far this year is about 6,739 compared to 13,000 last year. So we might get to 20,000 or so this year on that trend. That's still a very small number of people compared to the population of 5 million, compared to the general flows of migrants and workers and people in and out of Ireland. So it's become the lightning rod and the focus. And many of those people who have become that focus are really vulnerable and are actually fleeing traumatising situations around the world. So we need to keep that in perspective as well as dealing with the broader picture. We need to have services, we need to have a story we tell ourselves about migration, and we need to have a functioning system, and we have none of those things right now.
Okay. Wendy, you looked at that Sunday Times piece, Ireland's Immigration Poly Crisis by John Mooney.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I think is troubling, that a lot of the narratives and the headlines surrounding this are going to play into, and I would say it's a minority of people that have that kind of fear factor surrounding immigration. Look, ultimately, at the end of the day...
Now, if I could just say, in polls that are done, we might not like it, but in polls that are done, it does seem that a majority of people think there needs to be, tighter migration, that there are too many migrants, that the government is not handling it well. So it's not just like the so-called far right.
But the government's handling of migration is different to the general attitudes towards those who are coming to Ireland from other countries. And I think what the government has done a very bad job of doing is communicating well on this issue. For example, if you look at the research on migration across OECD countries, and the ESRI has said Ireland has done a terrible job at properly documenting the fact that in the majority of cases when it comes to migration over time, there's no net impact on the economy. And actually, when you support migrants when they arrive here and after that initial period of financial support, if they are given the opportunity to work in the countries that they arrive into, then they are an overall gain to the economy. We actually haven't told that story very well. And there's these kind of crass ideas around immigrants that have arrived here, you know, drain on the economy. Look, a lot of the frustrations that communities are having is nothing to do with the people that have arrived to this country. They are victims of the housing crisis, for example. They are not the cause of it. And as we've seen happening in different communities across Ireland, is that often the fears of the local communities are whipped up by a small but vocal minority, but also the lack of communication. I mean, county councillors in Wicklow were saying they'd written to Roderick O'Gorman, they were asking what the plan was for Newtown Mount Kennedy, and they weren't getting the answers. So, you know, if communities are left in the dark, then those fears, often that actually aren't founded on reality, will be allowed to grow. And on the other side as well, I think we need to be telling the enormously positive stories about experiences of local communities. The incredible, one of my neighbours is housing a Palestinian refugee because the conditions in Crooksling were so terrible for that man who just wants to work here, wants to contribute. How long will that process take before he can do that? Probably between 5 and 6 months. The processes are all too slow on the one hand. But on the other hand, when you look at those who are refused status here, something like less than 100 people were deported of the 7,300 that were refused asylum status here. Okay. So there is the two sides to it.
Just on Crooksling, I did hear a person who volunteers down at that increasingly surreal tent city in the middle of town. I mean, look, it's terrible, but it also is so bizarre to see it in the middle of our city. But a woman who volunteered down there, who is now also working up in Crooksling, and she said actually Crooksling has settled into being an infinitely better situation for people than being down there in the tents.
But the way that was
Mick.
I think there was another article in the the Times which gives a different slant on the whole thing. It was an author talking about interviewing heads of state and people in other countries and politicians.
This is Frank Mannion who's made a film. Yeah.
And I think that the seminal point in that, he talks about the Irish diaspora being 82 million people around the world. Well, if we hadn't been accepted into those countries, that diaspora wouldn't be there. We have done this ourselves. We are going to other places. I don't understand the difficulty we have with the small numbers of people who are actually coming here. You're correct. They didn't create the housing crisis. That has evolved over a significant period of time. They're victims of it. But to think that we're housing people in tents is very poor in this day and age.
Where should they be? Where can we put
them? Yeah, I honestly, I don't have an answer. I work as a doctor in the system, not a health economist or a political economist. But it's just crazy that this day and age that we don't have the focus on the housing that we need. There was another article in one of the papers about converting unused office accommodation currently into apartments, and it would cost something like 300,000 per unit. But
yeah,
if there is a huge...
Killian Woods in the Business Post.
In the Business Post, yeah.
And apparently it actually cost them 180 to do the conversions. They didn't have to buy the building. They said if we had to buy the building, it would have been 120 more, but 180 per apartment.
It just seems we've gone to a model now where there's people working from home, only have to be 2 days a week in the offices. Some of the large office buildings don't need to be as big as they are. Sorry, that's the wrong phrase, but some of the large employers they don't need the volume.
Okay.
And there is a way of getting housing stock that way, but it needs that investment.
We might come back to housing, but look, I think it's come across here again in the conversation, it's certainly coming across in the paper and all this week, is that there's a certain amount of confusion, I think, about the asylum process and how it works. Would everyone agree that, like, do any of us really know what the big picture of exactly what the steps are? So we'll try and get some clarity now. I'm joined by senior counsel Sonavan McDonagh, who practices immigration and asylum law and who has served on the Refugees Appeals Tribunal. Good morning, Sonavan.
Hello there, Brendan.
Okay, so look, we could do this for an hour, but let's try and kind of give people a clear picture quickly, because people were hearing this week about appeals. Did they come across the Justice Minister's desk? And she was saying, I don't know, I haven't seen any. And then it turns out the next day there are hundreds of them. So can we start with, what is the process from when an IP applicant presents themselves either at the port of entry or, as seems to be the case with the vast majority of them now, at the International Protection Office?
Okay, well, I think the first thing to say is that, you know, asylum seekers and refugees under the Geneva Convention, which is what this architecture is set up to look at, are only a subset of immigrants, migrants, other refugees or people from Ukraine or people who are settled from Syria or Afghanistan under Red Cross programs and all of that. So it's just a subset of, and that's all I'm speaking of.
Okay.
And just in terms of the Geneva Convention, it's quite a complicated test. So if you're going to end up being declared a refugee, you have to show that you've got a well-founded fear of persecution in your country of origin. And it has to be for reasons of race, religion, membership of a particular social group or a political opinion. And then you also have to show that you're unwilling or unable to avail of state protection in that country. So it's a, you know, it dates back to 1951 after the, you know, Second World War, and there were a lot of political refugees in Europe. So it's quite a complicated test in the very beginning.
Okay, and how quickly does that test happen, and how does it happen?
Well, that there are different stages, and obviously I'm not an expert on, you know, the precise stages, but there are a number of stages. And the first thing you must do is seek, you know, it's indicate that you are seeking asylum, and you're supposed to do that as soon as possible, but it's not a legal requirement because, for example, something bad could happen in your country while you're here for 5 years and all of that. But so most people, I think, historically did so at the, you know, ports or airports. And now it seems that a majority seem to be doing it at the IPO office. So they will register. They will be asked for their identity. They'll be asked, you know, have they any documentation? They'll have their fingerprints taken, which are sent to Eurodac, which is a European-wide organization which, you know, collates fingerprints of asylum seekers across Europe. You will be asked certain details, and then you will be asked, you will be given a date for a formal preliminary interview. And that will take place. Now, stop me if I'm giving too much detail, but it is quite complicated. So you will be interviewed by somebody from the Department of Justice. They may not be an employee. They may be a contracted lawyer, and they will ask you why you're seeking refugee status, conduct a long interview, typically maybe 10 or 12 pages. And then the actual decision will be made by an official in the Department of Justice.
And in your experience, yeah, how long does that process tend to take right now?
I understand that it's much quicker than it used to be. I honestly wouldn't like to say. I see you were speaking of the Sunday Independent, and it seems the minister wants to do that within 90 days. And there doesn't seem to be any reason why that can't be done in 90 days. I mean,
they'd need to throw a lot of resources at it, you'd imagine, to get it.
They're throwing quite a lot of resources.
Okay.
I mean, you know, but of course, with the increased numbers, the resources have to increase. But then, these are people who don't fall foul of coming from countries' accelerated procedures, who may ultimately, you know, not have a full, you know, oral interview. I mean, that's why people are you know, people, safe countries are accelerated processes.
Okay.
But there'll be a decision made, and then you will have a right of appeal, and you will have, you know, legal advice on this if you're an asylum seeker. And that will be to a completely independent body, which is the International Protection Appeals Tribunal, which used to be the Refugee Appeals Tribunal. You will then typically have an oral hearing there, where the tribunal member will decide whether or not you are a refugee, or, not to confuse things, but there's also a form of subsidiary protection where the test isn't so rigorous. So they will look at those, and ultimately they will be making a recommendation to the minister.
Okay, can everyone appeal?
Yes, everybody.
And how long does, do you know how long that process tends to take?
The full procedure has a full appeal. Everybody, just as it, the full procedure has a full oral appeal, but some appeals, if they're not in the full procedure, could be limited to a paper-based appeal.
Okay.
But everybody's
arrived. Do you know how long that takes?
Well, again, I know that there are understandable, resourcing issues in IPAT, although they have extensive people working there too. But it might be fair to, this is just an estimate, but it could certainly take a number of months typically. But I don't have that information at my fingertips, and
okay.
I understand to be corrected.
And let's take it as given then that somebody who is granted refugee status is then subsumed into the population of the country. If an appeal is unsuccessful,
refugee status internationally and historically, and it's an EU-wide concept. It's a worldwide concept, but we operate under EU procedures. It should be, you know, the declaration of a very important status and be subsumed into the community, as you say. But there are thousands of people who have not been, you know, who are still in direct provision. you need to be treated and get the housing, etc. So if you are not successful, the minister, and this is an important point as well, the minister also has a discretion whether or not to allow you to stay. And I would like to just emphasize that historically there have been major delays. So I've come across cases of children who are 7 and 8 who have been in the country, never been in any other country. And obviously their rights are very strong when it comes to the minister deciding whether, although the parents are failed asylum seekers, but they've made their life in Ireland. And don't forget, you can work as an asylum seeker after 5 months. So they may be contributing to the economy for 5 years. And so it's a very difficult decision. Does the minister decide, well, you can stay, and she also has to have a look at, you know, international law in that area? Or
so hang on, Suniva, just pardon my stupid questions here now. So a person whose appeal is unsuccessful, they have another route again whereby the minister can still decide they can stay, and the minister or her proxy decides on every one of those cases?
Yes, although in fairness, it's not another route because it's now part of the same procedure. So when the minister gets on her desk that this person should not be declared a refugee, she can, as it were, simultaneously, you know, look at whether there are strong humanitarian or indeed, you know, human rights reasons why the person should stay. And of course, overriding all of this, nobody should be sent back to a country where they would be in danger of being tortured, no matter what their merits. That's called the principle of non-refoulement. You don't send somebody back, you know, even if they've been found not credible or whatever, if they're in danger of being tortured in their country of origin.
Okay, so say somebody's appeal is unsuccessful and the minister does not make a decision that they should be allowed to stay. What happens next? I think people are confused as to, we don't seem to have a very small amount of deportations. Are people told voluntarily leave the country? Is there any follow-up check done on that?
Well, it seems just from the media, because it's not entirely clear, you know, how many and how long it takes for the minister to decide whether or not to exercise her discretion. And it's a very complicated task because the Fundamental Rights Agency, which I was a member of the board, I mean, obviously one would support a policy that a failed asylum seeker doesn't have a right to stay, you know, and is subject to deportation. But there may be strong humanitarian reasons why that wouldn't happen. So at that point, if the minister decides that a deportation order should be made, she writes a letter to you, and you will have your lawyer, hopefully, at this point as well. And she says, I'm planning to make a deportation order. Is there any reason I shouldn't? And she gives you what are called, you know, three options. She invites you to leave voluntarily, or voluntarily, perhaps with some assistance from a migration organization that might help you. Or she says, I if you don't leave voluntarily, I will propose to make a deportation order. Now, if you leave voluntarily, this is very important. You leave Ireland, as it were, without a stain on your immigration history. So you can come back if you can get a visa or if you, you know, but if you leave, if a deportation order is made against you, it is Europe-wide and in principle, it is very long-lasting. There is a discretion to end it after a while, but that's
okay.
Another.
So there is an incentive not to be deported. Okay,
there's
son of a MacDonagh.
Not to be deported.
Well done. Okay, thank you very much
okay,
for that.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Right, everyone clear now?
Brendan, she mentioned there that this the 90-day target, but as far as I can see from the report she mentioned, that is only for people under the accelerated process. So at the moment, that's the unsafe countries are now, which seems to me a slightly weird thing, it's now going to not only apply to unsafe countries, but countries where a lot of asylum seekers come from. I think that feeds back to this isn't, there's no real like legal coherence. It's just that, oh, that's a big problem now, we'll try and sort that. Because obviously the country from where a lot of people are coming could actually be because, it could be because there's a copycat, but it could also be because there's an actual issue there that people are fleeing. So it's seems slightly arbitrary that, oh, that now those who have a lot of countries with a lot of people coming from them will now be effectively deemed safe even when they aren't and processed very quickly.
They're not deeming them safe. They're not punishing people by giving them a quick process, or she?
Well, it's by this, from what I understood from her, it suggests that they don't have as full a hearing and as full an opportunity to put forward their case. It might only be written as opposed to oral. So that they certainly haven't got as much of an opportunity to put forward their case in that process.
I think the hope there is, and that was that accelerated process that's been in place for the unsafe countries, or the countries that are deemed safe, rather. So yes. And now what they're doing, and something Helen McEntee brought to Cabinet, is that every 3 months they're going to look at the country who has had the highest number of asylum applications in the previous 3 months. Right now it's Nigeria, something like 34% of all applications in the first quarter of the year have come from Nigeria. So it's more so, I understand it, trying to work as a disincentive that when you look at the number of applications that have come in from the 10 safe countries, since that they are, you know, a quicker acceleration progress, they're being looked at within 90 days.
So
there's
an element
of trying to disincentivize people to come. Now, it seems
to
be working
like
in the safe countries.
Yeah.
Oh, well, listen. Okay. You can say that about a lot of government policies.
Okay, listen, let's... move on to the broader issues the government face. Louise, the front of the Irish Mail on Sunday is Taoiseach has got 6 weeks to get results and inside Harris to go all in on law and order.
Yeah, so it looks that this new energy and this new hope that Simon Harris seems to have brought to Fine Gael and that I was hearing about at the RDET just 3 weeks ago seems to now be turning to get results within 6 weeks, Taoiseach. And of course, what's 6 weeks' time? It's the local and European elections, and we know that over the last couple of elections, Fine Gael hasn't had huge levels of success. So this new hope in Simon Harris is being said, you know, you really need to get your act together here. We need to return a good number of seats. And what was interesting is that Cabinet sources speaking to John Lee in the Irish Mail on Sunday saying that, look, Harris seems to be betting the house here on tougher immigration stuff when you look at him compared to when you look at Leo Varadkar, the kind of the language that's being spoken about in immigration. Someone described Leo as having a laissez-faire attitude to immigration of, you know, let them come in and we'll sort out the accommodation later. Not only that, then you have this new emphasis that seems to have come in from when Simon Harris was appointed Fine Gael leader on law and order. And people, Cabinet sources saying to John Lee, like, is that a good idea? Because you've one incident like you had in Dublin last autumn with the riots in Dublin or any of the other crime issues that we've seen in the capital city over the last year or so, that it's going to leave both Minister McEntee and the Taoiseach looking quite foolish, I think were the words used there. So it seems to be, you've 6 weeks now, what can you actually do on these really tough areas like immigration, like law and order in the next 6 weeks to actually ensure that our fortunes are turned around come the elections? It's
maybe
an easy task.
Yeah, maybe send signals is the idea. Wendy, allied to this whole and the law and order and all of that kind of thing, the Sunday Independent, and it's been in lots of the papers in the last 2 days, it's the aim to Ardesh or an annual gathering in case people missed it. You are picking a piece there in the Sunday Independent, the only party willing to listen to voters on big issues like immigration.
Yeah, so
is this narrative now that Pádraig Tobin is the oracle. He's the only man who can look into his heart and see what the people are thinking because he called it right on the referendums.
Well, that was one of the headlines post those two referendums, with that for a small party seemed to be the only leader that was in touch with the Irish electorate. The interesting thing, after that referendum at the Ardes yesterday, Pádraig Tobin, who's a leader of AIM2, said that they they experienced a 25% increase in their membership. So I suppose it did show that that resonated with the electorate.
Up to 2,000.
Yeah, so there was about 400 at the Oradesh yesterday, and so about 2,000 new members. So he's planning on running 64 local election candidates. Speaking to him, he thinks that 24 of them have a good chance. But I think it's interesting to see, you know, I suppose just when you look at the polls today and the Business Post, they're polling at 4%. You know, Labour's at 3%. And I guess it just does show the impacts that a grassroots movement can have. I think it's all in the same poll. It shows that I don't think Simon Harris has given the bounce that they thought they might have got from a new leader for Fine Gael, a slight one, but not so much. It hasn't created that bounce that they expected. He's got a few weeks to prove himself in terms of Simon Harris's. But I was looking at an old, because one of the pieces in this poll is talking about that the majority of people say they would favour more funding for services in this year's budget over tax cuts. But the same poll showed 60% of voters were in favour of abolishing the USC. And it was reminding me of those 2016 election posters that Fine Gael had. And you can see Simon Harris has, in many of them, where they were promising to abolish the USC. So it will be interesting to see after this very brief, I think it will be honeymoon period for Simon Harris. Will some of those previous promises that were made, will there be accountability there? I also thought it was very interesting in his speech at his inauguration. One of the first things that he did was he talked about the life and legacy of former Taoiseach John Bruton and thanked him for his influence. Now, many would say John Bruton would have been maybe the last true kind of Christian Democrat of Fine Gael, and a lot of his Fine Gael colleagues, Simon Harris' Fine Gael colleagues, were saying, is he going to go back to kind of core values of Fine Gael, that kind of Christian Democratic base that they have moved so far away from? I haven't seen that happening so far, but we'll see what happens in the remaining weeks.
So I'm just going to give the full results of that poll in the Sunday Business Post. It's a Red Sea poll, a poll of 1,027 adults conducted online between Friday the 19th and Thursday the 25th of April. And the margin of error here is plus or minus 3%. So Sinn Féin are up 2 at 27%. Fine Gael up 1 at 20%. Independents up 2 at 19%. Fianna Fáil down 2 at 14%. The Social Democrats unchanged at 6%. ANTU down 1 at 4%. Labour unchanged at 3%. The Greens down 1 at 3%. And People Before Profit Solidarity down 1 at 2%. So, Louise, any other politics there that we had?
Can I make an observation on that? Brendan, which I think there's a headline from, I think, a Gary Murphy article saying that Simon Harris should learn the lesson that Leo said, which is don't be too cautious at the beginning, you know, because go for broke on whatever, which is sort of the vibes he's saying. But as you say, Wendy, whether he'll deliver. I'm struck by the conversation we've had so far that if I had been Simon Harris, that the brave thing to do would have been to go and have a general election immediately to seek his own mandate. And also because it's far more likely that immigration will dominate local election politics around the country and actually elect candidates than if he'd gone straight for a general election. The issues would have probably reverted primarily to the big pocketbook issues around housing and health, and it might have been a debate with a greater perspective, a cleaner
Leo Varadkar's in the Sunday Times today. I think they were out canvassing with him and in the locals, and he was saying he always prefers the summer election. Okay, we will take a break. Our panel staying with us: Oisín Coughlan, Wendy Grace, Mick Molloy and Louise Byrne.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Oisín Coughlan, Wendy Grace, Dr. Mick Molloy and Louise Byrne are still with us. Mick Molloy, you are a consultant in emergency medicine. What jumped out at you in the papers today as regards the University Hospital Limerick and the story of Aoife Johnston?
Well, I think firstly, it's a terrible story. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be the last. I think we're in one of these watershed periods where things will get worse before they get better. And if you, I think, take the Business Post, the headline, Donnelly's Dilemma, record hospital spending yet war zone conditions. I think if you go back to some of the previous health service reports, some of the quotes there: high attendance rates in the emergency departments of acute hospitals, long delays in treatment, insufficient hospital beds, increasing proportions of hospital beds occupied by people admitted through emergency departments, cancelled elective admissions. That was written 25 years ago, and nothing really has changed. In fact, that report outlined we had 11,832 beds in the system then. We had 11,171 in 2021. So, in fact, we had less beds.
And we but I think we do have more now, don't we? There's 1,200 more since 2021. There were 1,000 put in during COVID.
I can think if it was possible to identify all these and put a barcode on them, an RFID, these beds, to see exactly where they are. Because you take some away, you add some in. We hear all about the ones that are added in. We don't hear about the ones that are taken away. I think the number in total is still less than we had in 2000, which is ludicrous.
Are you sure?
I'm sure.
I'm sure.
So the
health service in the last 10 years, we've put two-thirds more into it. It's gone from about 14 billion to about 23 billion.
Mm-hmm.
What's going wrong there? So,
I can't say that I have every answer, but we were terribly understaffed across a lot of the areas. We have ageing infrastructure, which is not really able to deliver. Many of the acute hospitals in our system were not funded by the system. They were funded by volunteer organisations and charities. And we have some places that are 200-year-old buildings trying to operate a modern health service in very, very distressed conditions and plaster falling off the walls. We've put a lot of good money after bad in trying to renovate these places rather than looking at how do you develop a modern facility, modern infrastructure, modern healthcare IT records, modern order comms. Or so when we're doing or ordering tests, it's not all done on paper where pieces of paper disappear. We have very inefficient...
Why hasn't that happened? What's the resistance to that as far as you can see?
I don't think it's a resistance. I think it's just IT projects. We have a national health service here. We have a single purchaser, a single organiser in the main. Coordinating large IT policies seems to have been excessively difficult here. If you go internationally where you've got hospitals which are independent, they organise their own IT infrastructure in that hospital. They're not looking for authorisation from two and three levels above them and approval of health spending from two or three levels in different organisations. Once they make a decision, they go, they do it, they implement.
If we had all different hospitals having different IT systems, I can imagine the stories we'd see in the papers about, you know, not, the records not being shared, not being compatible. It doesn't make sense to me in a small country to have competing IT systems.
I'm not talking about competing, but we do have that at the moment. I mean, we have a national IT system for radiology, but it doesn't exist in some hospitals. And they've got their own system, which is a little bit more advanced, so it doesn't talk to each other. So in my hospital, if you come to me and you say, I was in a hospital on the other side of the country yesterday, I had x-rays, I need you to follow up and see, do I need to have surgery in your hospital today or tomorrow, or has my fracture been healing? I can look at the x-ray from the day before. In most hospitals, in some I can't, because it's just not there. But we don't have a system where records are easily shared like that.
And even on a simple level like that, if somebody comes in with suspected sepsis, that anyone who encounters her in the chain, there's a barcode or something.
And they
look and they know that.
A little bit more complicated there. So when people arrive at an emergency department, they...
Mick, I don't want to get into blaming anyone
anything.
We're talking about general channels of communication.
Absolutely. Yeah. When they arrive, they get registered and checked in and somebody is given a barcode, and that is used for ordering labs. So it is used to identify
for
the individual.
If they need, whatever,
exactly. Yeah. But it isn't used for much else. It isn't used to enter into a record system. It's just for verification of you are who you are, because very commonly in Ireland, you'll have two John Murphys in the same place, two Elizabeth Malloys in the same place at the same time. Sometimes they even live in the same house. It could be mother and daughter at the same time with the same name. So to avoid any complications of people getting the wrong product, they're identified with the barcodes. But the electronic system behind that to look at trends of blood pressure and pulses and measurement,
That isn't integrated in emergency departments. It is in the operating theatre. If you're having your surgeries, they're recorded electronically. You can get a printout of that over a period of time.
But isn't one of the things keeping people out of emergency departments in the first place? Like when you compare, for example, Ireland's primary care system, you know, we've a similar population to Singapore. They have 23 primary care centres, which would be very different to what we would understand because they are diagnostic facilities where there's visiting consultants. We have 165, but they don't operate at the same level where people can be seen, you know, in the primary care setting. And having continuity of care with the GP, which I'm sure lots of people listening to don't have. I know it's nearly impossible to get an appointment for me or for my children with a GP quickly. So ultimately, some of those cases end up in emergency departments. As we've heard, you know, so many hospitals are operating out of older buildings where we need to look at efficiency. Simple things like pneumatic tubes that are taking samples to the lab rather than porters doing it, or mechanical beds that are able to move patients. And a lot of these older buildings, all of these simple efficiencies, like the time it takes nurses to walk from wards to wards, for example, a doctor was telling me that the productivity in different hospitals can be vastly different. One hospital performs 4 cataract surgeries a day compared to 24 in another. And a lot of that is about access to operating spaces. So how can we not stand back and look at the big picture and think of that headline and say, we've record spending yet war zone conditions?
Yeah, I think when you're looking and comparing other health services, we have to be comparing the same terminology. And primary care centre in Ireland means a very different thing to primary care centre in Singapore. Singapore's much better, challenges geographically in that it's much smaller area, the much more dense population, much easier to get to the populations. So effectively what they call a primary care centre, we would be calling a community hospital.
Okay, on the bigger picture that Wendy brings up of productivity, though, we have seen now in this new, economic evaluation service, the productivity and savings task force, which I'm sure is not popular with doctors, but the results so far, there's this massive variation in productivity that some places, the increase in productivity is maybe a half of the increase in staff or up to a third, apparently, of the increase in funding.
Okay, so productivity is a very tricky one to look at because, again, you have to compare like with like. So when you have a hospital which is over full, so our emergency department, for example, if we admit 60 people one day, some of those people are going to end up now in the daycare.
Where are you?
It's not fair to talk about the individual hospital. So it's just in general. If there's an over expected number of people admitted, they now go into what's called the daycare ward that night. So the surgeon who's meant to operate the following day now has no beds to operate. They're ringing their patients and cancelling. And this is happening across the board and happens more in some hospitals than others. There's a lot of mention in the last couple of years about a particular hospital which doesn't have trolleys. But what's not mentioned is that particular hospital had an extension done a short while before they were recording those figures. And you go, OK, so extra beds into a hospital and no trolleys. That's not really rocket science. And when there's been reports saying we're under capacity, and you put the capacity into that one hospital and then say, look at them, they're great, they've no trolleys. Well, that's because they've had the extra capacity. Put that capacity into other places as well and we'll
find...
Do
you think all this comes down to beds, yeah?
Honestly, it's a very simple thing to say, but it does, effectively. Okay. I mean, these are Department of Health reports that say that.
Without, I know you don't want to talk about individual hospitals, but war zone, death trap, I think one person said. You've been in actual war zones. I know you've worked in disaster areas and all that. Have you been in an Irish ED that feels actually like a war zone? Is it that bad sometimes, yeah?
So this is quite emotional for me. So this weekend last year, I had a temporary paralysis. I was in an emergency department for 4 days on a trolley. And despite knowing everybody I know in the system, there was no way to change that. I wasn't the only consultant in that hospital on an emergency department trolley for 4 days. There were two, and in fact, there was a third for a short period of time. It's just we are so over capacity, there's nothing. And it is like that.
So tell us a bit about your experience.
Well, I moved 11 different times within the emergency department from place to place. I had a short period of time where I was in a ward off the emergency department where I could sleep. But for the main, I was on a corridor. I was against a wall. I was in the middle of a corridor for a period of time. It's horrific. The lights are on all the time. It's a very efficient form of torture because you just can't sleep. Yeah. The noise is there all day. And I'm not complaining about the noise per se, but when people are sick and they need to be admitted to recover, it's not a way to recover when you're actually kept awake the whole time, because there's lots of new people coming in 24 hours a day. They're being dealt with. Sometimes they're in distress. There's a lot of noise, family disturbances. It's not the place to be. And unfortunately, we see the knock-on effect of this overcrowding does result in deaths. There was a very good publication done from the UK a couple of years ago, 2 years ago now, where they examined admissions for a 2-year period and found that people who spent longer than 6 hours in the emergency department waiting for a bed on a ward, there was one death for every 82 people. Unexpected. It shouldn't have happened. They went through this statistically and said that should not have happened. But that's a 6 hours. We have people who are 12, 18, and in my case, 72 and more hours waiting.
So we have one name this week that's been on everyone's mind and everything. But what you're saying, according to that statistic, which is quoted a lot, is that this week there were numerous people, again, died because they were too long in an ED, yeah?
Correct.
That we never hear about.
We won't hear about them.
Every day and every week, yeah?
We won't hear about them because the families don't necessarily know about them. People are going in sick in any case. But when you're going in sick from a pneumonia, there's a certain amount of things you need to do, or I need to do, to help treat that person to help recover. But they also need the rest. They need to be in the right place. They need to be getting their food. And you can't really get that very efficiently when you are in an emergency department.
And if it's like an overpacked airplane where nobody can move around. Oisin, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the health cuts in the late 80s. And so since then, I would have been of the view that what we needed was investment and what we needed was more capacity. And obviously, we have a growing population as well. But it is, you know, you quoted the figures. We've gone from 14 billion to 22 billion now, roughly, in the last decade. And yet it isn't, and this is what's interesting in that article by Daniel Murray in the Business Post about the dilemma between investment and outcomes. It doesn't seem to be delivering. There seems to be a significant reform that Stephen Donnelly is pursuing of this sort of accountability around productivity and linking future funding to the use of current funding, which hasn't particularly happened before. And that wouldn't have been where I would have started as the way to achieve this. But it certainly seems to like a significant change of policy from the government that's being done quite kind of steadily and quietly. But I am then struck, we don't even know for sure in this studio, have we more beds than we did 25 years ago?
Okay. No, we definitely don't.
I'm going to tell you something. I spent an hour Googling last night. You cannot find an actual figure. You can find various versions of people saying the ESRI, I think in December, said we need 1,000 more beds right now and 300 a year to keep up. But you cannot find actually a figure for how many.
But also, available theatre space has to match the increase in beds, well, you know, and the output of diagnostics. You know, we have machines that are worth hundreds of millions in some hospitals that are only used for 8 hours a day.
Right, yeah. That's what beggars belief. And I think when people hear about how much money is going into the health service, when you hear about, you know, that there's going to be a 1 billion euro deficit in the health budget this year, despite record investment, and you're hearing all this money and you're going, Jesus, isn't that great now that we're investing in the health service? But then people are going, turning around and saying, where is this money going? That we have situations like we do, people waiting on trolleys, people dying on trolleys, people not getting care that they could have very easily gotten because doctors and nurses and hospitals are so stretched. Yet this record investment, it baffles, it really does baffle.
Is a lot of the issue that at the head of a lot of these hospitals, there isn't enough medics sitting on the boards and from the management perspective. And then you look at hospitals like the Galway Clinic, the Hermitage and the Black Rock Clinic, which I understand are private clinics, but they were built on time and on budget. And many of those involved in building those hospitals tried to, for example, offer their expertise to the government when building the children's hospital for free, and those expertise were turned down. So is one of the issues that those who are running and managing these hospitals at the top, not, you know, in the area of, like, the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland
Let's
does have their
the people who are running specific hospitals.
But in terms of the management of who is running them, Brendan, it doesn't seem to be for the most part, those who are actually involved with patient care, and that is an important part.
I think
does health work much better in the private sector, much more efficiently? Do the do the doctors work harder if they're getting paid a per? Are they more inclined to come in and burn through stuff and everything? Is there more incentive there than feel that you're wading through mud in a public system where you're getting no thanks?
So in the private or independent sector, the hospitals figure out what are the things they can do most efficiently and effectively. And they do that very well.
Okay.
And they focus on that part. They don't, in general, have emergency departments that run 24 hours a day where they can admit somebody with a condition which might require 2, 3 or 4 weeks admission, whereas they function very, very effectively in doing elective orthopaedic surgery, elective cardiac surgery, where you know the person's going to be there for a day or 2 days.
A cherry pick.
That's a very unusual phase, because the whole health system, you have to look at the health system as a whole, public, private, the whole thing.
But they have no obligation to service everybody in the way of public system.
They don't. And that's a challenge, that they don't have that obligation.
But there are private EDs that seem to operate fairly effectively, but again, they're not getting the ambulances in,
they're not getting that. But just to talk about the point about the efficiency of the spending. If we look at the average length of stay, that's dramatically dropped in hospitals, which is one measure of efficiency. You look at the amount of daycare activity, that's gone up. But we could hire a lot of new surgeons into places, but unless you actually build the operating theatre space, the current ones are being used quite effectively. The current ICUs are all being used, like over capacity. But if we're going to add more surgeons, we can't say they're inefficient because they're not operating. But if you don't have the theatre space to operate in, you're not getting the beds to operate. It's kind of a bad measure of efficiency saying they didn't do anything.
Okay. I'm always reminded of Wendy's point about the IT system. I'm reminded of this guy, a doctor, who's passionately trying to build a kind of health IT systems. He said, like, if you order a pizza, you can look on your phone at the guy on the bike.
Yeah.
Where exactly he is. He'll be here in 2 minutes, like, or whatever. And he says, why don't we have something in the health service?
Well, in fairness,
okay, I'll have to take a break, Mick. Okay. Oisín Coughlan, Wendy Grace, Mick Molloy and Louise Byrne staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Oisín Coughlan, Wendy Grace, Dr. Mick Molloy and Louise Byrne still with us. Oisín, I better give you an outing on the environment because it is, after all, your thing. The Sunday Times, chips are down as rain hits potato crop.
Yes, things are getting real in the climate change world, Brendan. So,
do you feel this might be the wake-up call that people need potatoes?
You would hope so, but it's funny. I was telling your researcher that about 8 years ago, we ran a fundraising appeal based on the fact that climate change might affect things that are much closer to home than, you know, polar bears or sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah,
and we focused on the potato and no one gave us any money. So
okay.
I'm here today to say that you'd paid more attention. But it is really striking because we all know how wet a spring we've had and how wet a 6 months we've had. The potatoes simply aren't in the ground. There's going to be far fewer Irish-grown potatoes this year. And the head of Kyo's Crisps is saying because they also sell potatoes, they simply won't be able to sell 10 kilogram bags of potatoes. There won't be enough potatoes to fill 10 kilogram bags. They'll spread them out over five kilogram bags. And the price of potatoes is going to go up. And it's just a very small example of how the increasingly extreme weather we're getting from our changing climate system is having real effects, not only far away places or in the future, but right here and now in Ireland.
Okay, we've had a green government for some people would say wagging the dog or whatever for 4 and a bit years now. Do you think, is there a sense that people are going, well, we gave that a go now, we gave the Greens a go, and is there a growing?
I thought you were going to blame Emma Ryan for the lack of potatoes, such as that.
I'm sure someone will probably try.
So I think we're in a really interesting position because actually there has been significant progress in Ireland over the last 5 years, a better legal framework. Some of the coherence that we've talked about in other areas not being there today, in other issues, we have that coherence. We have policies and plans more than ever before. It's beginning to have an effect. We're likely to see figures from the EPA in the next few weeks that show that climate pollution fell by 4 or 5% last year. It's not enough. It needs to keep going. And there's a risk that politicians are going to lose their nerve just as they're making a difference, not just in Ireland, but at the European level. Because this time round, compared to 5 years ago when it was Greta and the school strikers, now we're hearing about farmers and protests on other issues. And it looks like politicians are kind of, well, maybe we should stop talking about that. And I did hear from someone that the politician called to their door and they asked about climate and the politician said, oh, we've kind of done that now, just as you described. And that would be really foolish because A, the threat is real and it's getting worse. And B, you're just about to make progress. And if you if you don't press on, well, we'll be back in 3 or 4 years' time with more and more climate disasters and people being outraged that you didn't take action when you could have. So,
but you can understand people being frustrated, you know, that policies are put in place but without infrastructure. So we run car house, we cycle to school, cycle to work, all that sort of stuff. But it's not... I don't feel safe on the roads. On the part where there's raised cycle paths, fine. But there's a huge proportion of our journey. My husband's already been knocked off his bike on more than one occasion, literally decked out head to toe, fluorescent man. Everybody knows him in the village.
Can we mention the sides of the roads where the cyclists are supposed to cycle are the worst part of the roads in terms of potholes and
glass.
You're going to have to like come out suddenly at times, aren't you? You agree, Mick?
Yeah, and they don't seem to get the attention from the councils, to be honest, because my kids all cycle to school and they're coming ringing me, can you pick me up? Why puncture again? You know, the glass is not picked up from the sides of the road for whatever reason.
We actually sweep the glass regularly on cycle paths, go out with the sweeping brush in the back of the bike trailer and have to do it ourselves.
There is more money for this infrastructure than ever before, €365 million a year compared to what, like a fraction of that before. It is getting spent in some places, but councils have been slow. There is real inertia and lag in the system.
But there's no connectivity. Like around the corner from me, there's been a road dug up twice over the last 2 years and they haven't put a cycle path or a footpath in, even though this amount of money and work is happening, because there's no joined up thing.
The politicians are going to be calling to our doors in the next 6 weeks. We need to tell them this.
Yeah. Okay. And people will be mentioning some crisps as well. The crisp panic could be what called, never mind potatoes.
I think it will.
If there isn't enough crisps, like people will be, and it's the environment's fault, people will want it sorted. Okay, thank you very much to my panel today, Oisín Coughlan, Wendy Grace, Dr. Mick Molloy and Louise Byrne.